today, how the far right is teaming up across borders to target next week's European elections. And Simon Hattonstone on how an accidental voicemail message revealed the worst instincts of two G4S staff. Across Europe, populists are on the rise. There's Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán.
Októbert írunk, de Európában már mindenki a májusra gondol.
Marine Le Pen, leader of France's National Rally.
Il faut sauver l'Europe de l'union qui la détruit. Il faut sauver la réalité européenne.
And Matteo Salvini.
L'immigrazione da fenomeno relativamente modesto e controllabile è diventata un'invasione.
Italy's Deputy Prime Minister believes he can build a pan-European alliance to promote his far-right vision for the next 50 years.
Salvini is Interior Minister, but considered Italy's most powerful politician. He's also positioning himself as Europe's populist-in-chief.
Matteo Salvini has organised these gathering here in Milan of right-wing European Nationalist Party to build a new alliance, but mainly to launch his European elections campaign. As explained,
and he believes next week's European elections could be a breakthrough moment. From The Guardian, I'm Anoushka Astana. Today in focus, the rise of the far right across Europe.
So think of the European Parliament a bit like a camembert, in other words, a cheese.
Jennifer Rankin is The Guardian's Brussels correspondent.
So it's a half wheel of cheese. That's how people refer to it here. That's why I'm using the phrase. So we've got MEPs making up the semicircle, and that semicircle is divided up into different slices, into different portions, and each slice is a group. And in the current European Parliament, we have eight groups, and these groups are the political families. So if you're a Labour MEP, you sit in the party of Socialists and Democrats. If you are a Green MEP, you sit with your fellow Greens from across Europe. And that's how it's always worked. So we have these eight different groups. And the most significant ones are the European People's Party, which sounds like a sort of quite a radical group, but in fact is the name for the traditional centre-right forces. So that's the group of Angela Merkel, former French President Nicolas Sarkozy, and also it used to be the group of the British Conservatives. Back to the sort of second largest slice of the cheese, that's traditionally the Socialists and Democrats. So together with the EPP, traditionally, these two forces have had more than 50% in the seats in the European Parliament since the very beginning. But this year, this time, everybody thinks, based on the polls, that the centre-right and centre-left will fall below 50%. So that's causing a lot of anxiety and uncertainty about how you build pro-EU majority in the next European Parliament.
Is it unusual that there's now so many Eurosceptic MEPs within the EU?
Before the European Parliament, the European Economic Community, as it then was, had an assembly of parliamentarians, and these were self-appointed. So they came to Brussels and Strasbourg to meet and discuss and talk about European legislation, but without having any say in writing it. But from the very beginning, it's quite interesting because these early parliamentarians in the 50s, 60s, 70s, they took the decision that you had to be for the project in order to be in this assembly. So they took the decision to exclude communists because communist parties were against the European Economic Community. They saw it as too capitalist. And I think that's created an interesting sort of dynamic where even before we had direct elections in 1979, the culture was very much about being pro-EU, about being for the project. And that's been changing over the last 10 to 15 years, where we've seen increasing numbers of Eurosceptic politicians, of parties that want to destroy the EU from within.
So European elections happen twice a decade and we're upon them now. Can you tell us how many people are running for how many seats?
So the parliament consists of 751 MEPs, and the elections will take place in all 28 countries of the EU, including, of course, the UK, a campaign that the government had hoped to avoid. So the elections will start on the 23rd of May, on a Thursday, in the UK and the Netherlands. But we'll see most countries not voting until the 26th of May, a Sunday, or the traditional day for many countries in Europe to vote. And then we'll get the results Sunday night in the early hours of Monday morning, and we'll know who has been elected to the parliament. But that said, then we enter into a period of horse trading. So in a way, after the elections comes a second phase of deciding who will get the power in the European Parliament, because that's when all the MEPs will decide which groups they are going to join. So the Conservative Party would decide whether it wants to remain in the European Conservatives and Reformist group, the group that Cameron set up. I mean, no reason to doubt that they won't, but that's just to give an example. So everyone have to decide how they want to line up on the board of the European Parliament. And that process could take several weeks as different national parties will try and form new alliances.
Explain to me why all these different groupings matter.
So in the European Parliament, not in a dissimilar way from a national parliament, you need to find a majority to get things done. And typically, MEPs in the same group are meant to vote together. Of course, that doesn't always happen. You find individuals who have things to disagree about, but you can only get a majority if you can muster a coalition of MEPs in favour. And it certainly makes that process easier if the groups are voting in a predictable way according to positions they've already worked out.
And so one of the things a lot of people are wondering is what will be the impact of far-right parties in these European elections?
So populist right-wing parties have been on the rise for some time, and we saw that in 2014, and they will continue to gain, according to the polls, in the current European elections. And now they're looking for ways to see whether they can work together. So we saw Matteo Salvini recently reach out to Viktor Orban to talk about forming a new alliance.
It's not just Orban in Hungary who Salvini is trying to woo. He wants to use electoral success for far-right, anti-immigrant parties to build a new pan-European alliance that could bring together parties from France, Germany, Denmark, Finland, Poland, Estonia and more. Recently, The Guardian's Sean Walker travelled to Milan to hear Salvini unveil his plans.
Okay. Buongiorno, volevo sapere se questo è soltanto appunto l'antipasto, la premessa.
It was this grand hotel just near Milan Central Station, and they hired out this big kind of function room in the hotel. And I went in, and there was kind of chaos. I mean, there were journalists from all over the place, load of Italian journalists obviously there for Salvini, also quite a few journalists from different countries. It felt like, you know, really quite a significant news event. And so, you know, it was a sort of multilingual event. We were sitting there in headphones, translating between German, Italian, and English. Salvini, I think, just hit off these themes which, you know, we've been hearing again and again from this kind of politician in many European countries. It was all about Europe losing its identity, about Brussels having too much power, about the sort of invasion of migration, needing to stop that from happening, and really kind of, you know, veering from simply centre-right concerns about stronger borders to some pretty much racist rhetoric about preserving Christian Europe, preserving white Europe, fears about population replacement, and all of these tropes that we hear from a lot of these parties.
And what's Salvini like in person? Was he charismatic?
He is quite charismatic, yes. I've seen him a couple of times now, both there and in Milan, and then he came to visit Budapest a couple of weeks ago. And he's got this, you know, he does have this Italian charm. He's quite careful in what he says most of the time, although he will say things like, in a generation, Europe will be an Islamic caliphate if we don't change things. So he's, you know, he's not always careful.
So clearly, a common thread among all these parties is migration. But this is coming up as an issue even in countries that haven't had large numbers of people arriving.
So I think traveling around over the last few months, in mostly in Central and Eastern Europe, and talking to these different far-right leaders or politicians in different countries, clearly migration is the biggest part of this concern they say they have about nation states losing their identity. I was just last week, I was in Estonia, where they haven't really seen any kind of mass migration in the last few years. However, the nationalist party EKRE, they just had parliamentary elections in Estonia, and this party won a decent chunk of the vote and now has 5 out of 15 cabinet positions.
And you met a far-right MEP candidate while you were in Estonia.
Yeah, that's right. I met this chap called Jaak Madison, who is an MP in the Estonian parliament and will be their MEP if they get over the threshold in the European elections.
So we are losing money. We're losing the money and we are losing the control over the country, like in the society, like inside here.
I think that the thing that I got most from the interview with him was just this sense that this is the moment for the nationalists, that this was somebody who, he was actually one of their few MPs in the previous Estonian parliament. And I got the sense that, you know, they had been treated as a bit of a freak show, that they were seen as extremists. And now here they were, they have the interior minister, the finance minister, they're looking to get an MEP. And like in many other countries, what was once extreme fringe is now part of the mainstream.
So in Milan, Salvini clearly attracted smaller parties from Denmark, Finland, the AfD from Germany, and clearly there's interest in countries like Estonia. But he wants to attract a few really big players, and one of them is Viktor Orban in Hungary, whose Fidesz party has been part of the centre-right grouping, the European People's Party. You live in Hungary. Is there a sense that that relationship is under pressure?
Well, the European People's Party is ostensibly a centre-right grouping, and they have a number of parties in it that are classic liberal centre-right parties. And some of those forces have been becoming increasingly uneasy over the years as the Orban government seems to have been getting more and more radical, both on issues of migration, but also on kind of rule of law, and just generally a feeling that this is not a government which belongs in a centre-right grouping, that this is a government that has become a far-right government. So at the beginning of April, I went to an event in Budapest, just on the Danube, in this big contemporary building where Fidesz, Orban's parties, often hold these big congresses. And that was their big launch of their European campaign. And there wasn't really much surprise about it. I mean, I moved to Hungary a year ago, and the discourse of migration, of stopping migrants, of protecting Christian Europe. I mean, it's such a huge part of the narrative. It feels like every day someone is standing up and talking about it. There's very little talk about education, healthcare, corruption, other issues. So it wasn't much surprise that the big message for this campaign, yet again, migration. And that was well received by Fidesz, and that's what they're going to the polls with.
The message that Sean Walker was hearing in Italy, Hungary and Estonia is echoed in France, where Paris correspondent Angelique Chrysaphis has been reporting on the European election campaign of Marine Le Pen's national rally. Can you just tell us what the key policies National Rally are pushing?
Right. Well, it's immigration, immigration, immigration. This is also playing out on the national scene. So this has always been an anti-immigrant party, anti-immigration party, xenophobic party, accused of all sorts of things that has played up issues of the dangers of Islam.
Le Rassemblement National passe devant la liste de la République en marche dans les intentions de vote.
The far right in France is really one of the leading parties in this coalition of nationalist and far right forces. And the whole idea of Marine Le Pen in France, she doesn't want a Frexit. She doesn't want France to leave the EU. She wants instead to sort of wreak havoc from inside the EU. And the idea is, with allying with Matteo Salvini and these other far right parties, they can do that at the same time as hoping to build their national power base.
So presumably we shouldn't read too much into the fact that she wasn't at Matteo Salvini's initial press conference announcing the plan for this new grouping. But has she signalled her support in other ways?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, she's constantly referencing Matteo Salvini. They're very close. The relationship is fascinating because they don't share a joint language. They communicate in smileys via text message with broken English. And it's become a sort of a family affair in a sense because her very important niece, Marion Maréchal, who was France's youngest MP and has now taken a step back from politics but will be back in the future, no doubt, she fiercely protects her private life. And yet she's been paparazzied on beaches with a new partner who's part of Matteo Salvini's party, and they've been hailed by Italian Vanity Fair as the chic far-right couple of the future. So we're back to this idea in France of this Le Pen soap opera, this far-right, blonde, photogenic family who bring people out to the ballot box.
It's quite a long-running soap opera. I mean, Marine Le Pen has been on the public stage for a long time.
I mean, Marine Le Pen has undertaken for many years to sort of try to move away from this jackbooted image of anti-Semitism of a paratrooper, Holocaust-denying father Jean-Marie Le Pen. However, the fundamental ideas of the party, especially in terms of immigration and France from the French, remain the same. And we've seen in recent days in rallies her very sort of photogenic young candidate who's leading her list, who's a 23-year-old Jordan Bardella, has absolutely come back to this idea, France for the French. Now, that is an old idea from the 1970s and 80s in the far-right party, which has now been renamed, but which clearly keeps this idea of France for the French, immigrants come second, we want French people to be first in line for jobs and benefits. That is a crucial cue that she's sending to her voters that the party stands firm.
So Jordan Bardella is 23 years old. Just tell me about him.
Well, he is 23. He was born in the banlieue, so he was born in the poor, high unemployment area, Saint-Saint-Denis, north of Paris, which became very well known for riots. Boy, has he played that up. So he grew up just being raised by his mum, who hailed from Italian descent in a kind of very grey, high-rise suburb. He joined the far right at the age of 16. He was so young that his mum had to sign his papers of joining the party. And he plays this card very well. You know, I grew up not in a forest, but in a forest of grey tower blocks. Too much immigration around me, too much insecurity.
But sorry, just to check something, didn't you say that he was born to an Italian? I mean, is he an immigrant?
Well, absolutely. His mum was, not him. He was born in France. But we're looking now at this idea, which is kind of unspoken, but there, good immigrant versus bad immigrant.
So his immigrant mother signed his papers for him to become a candidate in the far-right party?
Yeah, absolutely. She wasn't a member of the far-right at the time.
Wow, that's amazing. And he is quite popular. Is he likely to be elected?
This is really interesting. He's at the top of the list, so he will take a seat. Now, if you look at the French far-right's history, 5 years ago, they swept the polls in France. This allowed Marine Le Pen to just go crazy with this for years, saying, we're the biggest party in France. Now, they've been neck and neck or slightly behind Emmanuel Macron's centrist pro-Europe party, and they have just in recent days started to edge ahead.
And when candidates were asked to bring a prop along to a TV show recently, Bardella brought a sieve. What was that all about?
It's been a metaphor that the far right in France has used for at least a decade about the idea that Europe is a sieve, that everyone can flow through the borders, that Europe is not protecting anyone from anything, and that immigrants are flowing in. Of course, in France's case, it's very different to Italy. We do not have in France people flooding over a border at all. It's definitely not the case.
So you've talked about Marine Le Pen wanting to wreak havoc within the EU. Emmanuel Macron, on the other hand, wants to fix the EU. He wants a more federalist EU.
Et ce moment, c'est celui qui nous sépare des élections européennes à venir, où nous aurons à faire vivre nos combats.
So how do they kind of contrast to each other?
This is hugely interesting and very important in France at the moment. It's a replay of the presidential election 2 years ago, Emmanuel Macron versus Marine Le Pen. The problem is the stakes, ironically, for Macron are almost even higher. You know, he swept into power. He was 41. He'd never run for politics before. He said he was going to disrupt everything and reinvent politics and reimagine the EU so people would come to love it again. If in the first major test for his new electoral party, which grew out of nothing, he loses in the sense that Marine Le Pen comes first in the European election, he is in certain amount of trouble. This idea that, hey, I'm the champion of Europe, I'm champion progressives, will have taken a massive hit.
It's interesting because Macron, as well as sort of contrasting his views on Europe with Le Pen, is in a way trying to spell out a vision for Europe that contrasts with Salvini and contrasts with the grouping that Salvini is trying to bring. I mean, to what extent is this kind of an existential battle between the two of them over the future of Europe?
This is an absolutely existential battle. I mean, it's been vicious. I mean, we've had a huge diplomatic spat between France and Italy over this, when Emmanuel Macron's used really strong language, you know, talking about leprosy, the leprosy of the far right.
What does he mean by leprosy of the far right?
Well, he's just talking about a sort of disease spreading through Europe, essentially, that has to be stopped, that's destroying everything, really.
Jennifer, we've spoken to Sean Walker and Angelique Chrysaphis. You're in Brussels, you'll be watching all the results come in. Do you think that Nigel Farage's Brexit Party, that is polling incredibly well here in the UK, could become part of this alliance?
Nigel Farage has always said that he wouldn't sit with Marine Le Pen. So if he did in this parliament, that would be a real break with his party. And we don't have any signs yet that he's ready to make that move.
And do you think this is the moment that all these parties will successfully form this alliance?
It's really not obvious at the moment how the far-right parties and how the authoritarian right parties are going to work together in the next European Parliament. Because all the opinion polls show that right-wing anti-EU parties are going to win a greater number of seats in these European elections, potentially around 70 seats for Matteo Salvini and parties associated with him. But what we don't know yet is whether these parties can work together. And traditionally, it's always been very difficult for nationalists to work together in harmony. We've seen attempts in the European Parliament before to create a sort of an international of nationalists, and often it falls apart because they can't agree.
Do you think this is going to be a massive moment for the far right? Could they tip the balance within the European Parliament?
I don't think they will tip the balance, and I think it's possible to overstate the influence of populist and the far right in the next European Parliament. But I do think they are having a bigger impact. And above all, I think they will have a big impact on the debate in the European Parliament. We've seen so many from different far-right MEPs, we've seen sexist and racist comments. And I think you might see more of that if these MEPs are coming back to the Parliament in greater numbers. So I think the biggest outcome could be on the debate and the sort of symbolic effect rather than on the nitty-gritty of EU legislation.
Coming up, something that is going to outrage you. Now, Guardian feature writer Simon Hattonstone on a shocking story involving the private security company G4S.
So, last week in Kent, a patient was waiting for a non-emergency ambulance. In Kent and Medway, the non-emergency ambulances are run by G4S.
Save messages. The next message is 4 minutes long.
So he gets a message, voicemail message, saying they're going to be 10 minutes late.
G4S ambulance service. Should be picking you up in about 10 minutes.
And then they put the phone down. Only they don't. And that's when things get really disturbing.
Well, he's homeless, he's aggressive, he's suicidal.
The first thing that they do is talk about the man's situation without any sympathy or empathy. He's got mental health problems and he had been homeless, but he had never been aggressive to any member of G4S staff. The two crew members then go on an incredibly violent rant against the man. They say that,
you know, have to take him if you don't feel safe with him.
If you don't feel safe with him, you can take the fire extinguisher off the hook and hit him with it. They say that it's better to beat a patient to a pulp than be beaten to a pulp. And that if you were to beat the fuck out of someone and then get prosecuted, it's still better than having it happen to you.
You want a broken broken arm, a broken jaw, black eyes, or do you want to beat the fuck out of someone and get prosecuted? You can still say self-defence.
The two G4S ambulance drivers then say they can always argue that it's self-defence, and if the worst comes to the worst, they'll get suspended for 6 months and can spend it sitting in their gardens having a nice time.
At least you're able to sit in your garden.
The two ambulance crew members then go on this bizarre meandering conversation about all the people they're spotting in the street as they're driving along, whether they're working or not, whether people bother working these days. They talk about the royal baby. And then finally, at the end, they realise that they've left this voice message on the very man that they're picking up, the patient.
What's a long message on his
answer? To return the call, key 5.
But it doesn't seem to have struck them that this has consequences. G4S is this massive British security company. Last year it won £1.4 billion worth of contracts. It's involved in all kinds of public services. This isn't the first time by any means that they've been involved in a scandal. My colleague Eric Allison, who's the Guardian's prisons correspondent, and I have been looking at them for the best part of 15 years. It started in 2004 when Gareth Myatt, who was 15 years old, died after being restrained in a secure training centre run by G4S. One of the guys who restrained him was 6'1", 16 stone. He was 6 stone, 7 pounds at the time. In 2016, The Guardian and Panorama exposed G4S staff abusing and humiliating young prisoners at Medway Secure Training Centre. Perhaps most shockingly, in 2013, G4S security guard Clive Carter was jailed for 20 years after murdering a conference delegate in Scotland. He followed her into the ladies' toilet and bludgeoned her to death with a fire extinguisher. This is why our patient got in touch with us. He'd heard the message about the fire extinguisher, and he thought that could have been him. This new case horrifies me. The idea that they're doing this with vulnerable patients is just inconceivable, really. And the idea that they're still getting the contracts and never seem to have to pay for it in any way is just appalling. Surely by now, government and people giving out the contracts realise they're not fit for purpose. Every time they say, sorry, it was a bad apple, we've got rid of them, we've suspended them. Well, how many bad apples can they have before we stop giving them these contracts? I've been in touch with the patient quite a bit over the last few days. He's absolutely distraught. He was distraught at the idea that he was portrayed as aggressive and violent because he had mental health problems. He says his mental health problems are severe, but he says that he's actually been self-harming since this incident happened in the last week. The implications of it are shocking, and the effect that G4S continues to have on individuals' lives is terrifying.
That was Simon Hattonstone. He got this response from the managing director of G4S Patient Transport Services, Russell Hobbs. He said, "We are appalled by these comments. We have apologised unreservedly to the patient, and the employees concerned have been suspended pending a full internal investigation. The comments are completely unacceptable and do not represent our values or the views of the rest of our hardworking team." G4S refused to say whether the two employees were suspended on full pay. That's all we have time for today. My thanks to Jennifer Rankin, Sean Walker, Angelique Chrysafis, and Simon Hattonstone. Today's episode was produced by Mithali Rao and Josh Kelly. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.